Bhadram karne pishnu yama devaha Bhadram pashe makshabhirya chatraha Stirai rangai istushtu vagum sastanubihi Yashema devahitanyadayuhu Swastina indro vridashravaha Swastina pusha vishwavedaha Swastina staraksho arishtanemihi Swastino brahaspatirtatu Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Okay, we are on verse 14, the Advaita Prakarana, the chapter 3, and verse 14. Okay. Jivatmano pratatvam yata Jivatmano pratatvam yata Pragutpate prakirtitam Pragutpate prakirtitam Bhavishyat vritya gaunam tata Bhavishyat vritya gaunam tata Mukhyatvam hi nayujyate Mukhyatvam hi nayujyate Jivatmanaha, Jivatmanoho, Pritaktvam, Yet, Prak, Utpattehe, Prakirtitam, Bhavishyat, Vritya, Gyanam, Tat, Mukhyatvam, Hi, Niyujate. We did this last week, we did some of it last week, we didn't finish it, right? You have that marked down?
I know we started it.
So we'll finish it today, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
2 weeks ago.
If you remember in the verse 13, in a sense, this is a continuation of verse 13. Verse 13. It said the ananyatvam, the oneness between the identity between the jiva and the self, is prashasyate. It's praised through all the comments about abheda, non-duality, right? So the oneness of the atma is really what we call the tatparya. It's what the Upanishads, what the essential message of the Upanishads are, is that this jiva is Brahman, that this innermost self, the conscious being that I am, the atma that I am, is the self of the creation, is the self of Ishwara. So that's the tatparya, that's the vision of the Upanishads. And also, how do we even know that? I mean, how do we know? This is coming again from the previous verses. The idea is this. The oneness, the identity between yourself and Brahman is what is praised throughout the Upanishads. What is censured or negated, nind means, you know, to censure, to speak against, to show as false, is the nanatvam. So it says nanatvam nindyate yat, that which is the duality, that is something which is censured. Every step of the way it is negated, and it is always resolved in all the Upanishads. It's always resolved into the Advaita, in the non-duality. And then that's praised. The non-duality is praised. The non-duality of yourself, the oneness of yourself, the Advaita, the non-dual nature of the creation. It's praised by such things as saying, the one who sees, this is a censure, the one who sees even the slightest, or has even the slightest whiff of duality, experiences this whole universe with even the slightest bit, sees only the slightest bit of duality, that person has bhaya. Fear. The one who has knowledge, the one who recognizes the self, has abhaya, is fearless, is free. There's so many verses like that in the Upanishads. So he says, if when that is understood, because when we're looking for what is the vision of the Upanishads, what is the vision? What is their tatparya? Where are they resolving? Are they resolving in duality, or are they resolving in Advaita, in non-duality? Says, no, they're resolving in non-duality. It's the non-duality that is continually being praised. It's the dvaita that is continually being censured as the source of birth and death and the source of fear, etc. So, understanding, if you understand it like this, then the Tatparya, what the Upanishad is actually saying, should become obvious to you, right? Otherwise, they would be censuring non-duality and saying, "You're a fool, you know, you muda, or you deluded one, thinking that there's nothing but non-duality. Can't you see that the only duality is real?" Rather, they're saying, "Oh, mudaha, oh, deluded one, this duality that you think is real, all of this birth and death that you're suffering from, all of the fear that you're experiencing, that's all mitya. That's not real. Yourself is free from fear. Yourself is one without a second. There is no second thing. The ananda, the wholeness that you experience only momentarily in the creation, that has for its source your very being. You are the very being. You are the very love that you seek." So this is going on and on. And so here in Shankara's commentary, he gives so many quotes in this chapter, in this verse 13 that we went through when we did that verse. And so now certain doubts come up about this, that in this verse, that the doubt is like this. In the first part of the Vedas, you know, the Vedas have two parts, the Karmakanda and then the Uttarakanda. The Karmakanda and the Jnanakanda. Karmakanda is that section that deals with karma, what's going on within the creation. All of what is dharma? What are the rituals? What are your duties? What are the rituals that can be done to fulfill your desires? How do you fulfill your desires? If you're unable to fulfill a desire, there's certain rituals and things I can do to evoke that grace in order to fulfill those desires. And in order to avoid any unnecessary suffering, there are certain attitudes that are very helpful, and there are certain dharmas that I have to follow as an individual. So that's all the first part of the Vedas. But the first part of the Vedas all accept totally duality. They're all about duality. What do I do? Here I am in this world as a jiva, as an individual. What do I do in order to have some sort of stability, some sort of fullness? What do I do? That's the first part of the Vedas. They completely accept duality. The second part of the Vedas, the Upanishads, the Jnanakanda, that section that deals with jnanam, negates duality. It makes the whole creation mithya. It negates the reality of the creation. So the Purva Pakshi, the objector, can say, okay, you have one portion of the Vedas that's this big, and then you have the little Upanishads, which are this big. Mm. You know, this Karmakanda, you know, accepts duality completely and talks about Swarga Loka and all dharma and all the rituals that you can do to have some ananda. Why are you saying that that one's not real? And that this one is what is, and the little Upanishads are what is real? But that's the doubt. So he says here, to just see how he's going to resolve this doubt, he says, jivatmanaha, jivatmanoho, between the jiva and the atma. Here atma is Brahman. This jiva means the atma, which is taken to be limited. When we say jiva, same atma, same self, but that self is taken to be limited because of ajnana, because of ignorance. That's what makes the jiva. There's no real jiva. There's no second atma, as though there's this little atma that we call the jiva. What makes the jiva, the transmigrating entity, is the ajnanam that makes this conscious being that I am appear as though limited. That's why we call it the jiva. That because of that ajnanam, the sukshma sharira, with the mind identified with the self, and then the mind, the sukshma sharira, the subtle body transmigrating, we call this entity the jiva. But really what it is, the jiva is the self which is taken to be limited. Right? Why it's important to say this is because otherwise you take yourself to be a jiva and then Ishwara's self to be limitless. Mm-hmm. Right? But that's true. That's the problem. That is exactly the problem. That distinction between this conscious being that I am and the conscious being which is the Lord, which is Ishwara, the conscious being which is infinite, the fact that I take them to be different is due to ajnanam, is due to self-ignorance. Right? And so here when they say the prithektvam, the separation, the separateness, the state of being two, the state of being distinct between the jiva and the atma. The jiva and the atma here is the atma, which is Brahman, which is limitless. So the limited atma and the atma. The limited atma is that atma brought about by ignorance, by ajnana. There is no limited atma. There's only one atma. And the one atma, the one self, that you are, is the self of the entire creation. This one self, this conscious being that you are, is the one self in all beings. So the self that I am is the self that you are, is the self that you are, is the self that Ishwara is the self that all animals are, that all beings are, that all plants are. It's the self that the table is. The table just doesn't have a sukshma sharira, it doesn't have a subtle body. But its being, it has the same one being. The whole creation has the same one being. You know? So that separateness between the jiva and the atma, between the jiva and Brahman, that separateness is something that is declared, talked about, and discussed prak utpatehe, before there's any talk about the creation per se. Now what they mean there, there's two ways to take this. In the first part of the Vedas, you are in the creation, right? You are a jiva in the creation, following Dharma and trying to get a better next birth, and also to go to higher lokas and not lower lokas, higher worlds, not lower worlds. So in the first part of the Vedas, you're within the creation. And there's nothing in you. You're not a mumukshu. You're not somebody in the first part of the Vedas. It's not for the mumukshu. It is a little bit, but I'll tell you how that is in a minute. The first part of the Vedas is talking to the one who is a samsari, the one who believes, I am a jiva, I am an individual in this creation, and I am held by within the Vedic culture and with the Vedas as my scripture, as revealed knowledge. I have shraddha, I have faith in that scripture. And the scripture tells me what are my duties, what are my dharmas, you know, how to live a dharmic life, and what austerities I can do, what upasanas, what types of meditations I can do along with dharma to gain punya, to gain merits, which will help me to gain a better next birth, and also to go to higher lokas in between births here, to help me to go to higher lokas. And to always improve my lot in terms of getting a body at least this good and hopefully better. Hopefully a better one, you know? You know, more intelligence, more capacity, more beauty, more secure life, more money, more friends, more family. Family of people who are good people. Children, good children, not problem children. Good children who I can feel, you know, feel proud of. Not children that worry me, children that really make me feel proud. So all of these things, I'm working for all of these things through Dharma and through Dhanam. Dhanam means giving charities. There's all kinds of things that the first part of the Vedas will tell you to do in order to gain punya. You know, to gain punya so that you'll be blessed in your next birth and in the other and the different worlds that you'll experience in between births. So this is the life. This is a person's life. There's no one at this point for the samsari. The samsari means the one who's continually caught in this birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, sukha, dukkha, pleasure, pain, pleasure, pain, pleasure, pain, the cycle. But there's no one for the samsara yet, in the first part of the Veda. So this is 99.999% of the world, the people, because this world is your sense organs, your organs of action, your hands, your feet, etc., your voice, you know, everything, your sexuality, everything is designed to participate in this world and to gain some happiness from it. So the first part of the Vedas tells you how to do that and how to fulfill desires without going outside of Dharma. All of these things, it's very clear and has all kinds of stories and everything, all kinds of rituals, everything you need. It's a handbook for how to gain relative happiness in this world. But for that person, there's nobody yet. asking the question, what is this creation? Where did it come from? What is it? Who am I in it? What is the truth of this whole thing? What is the truth of this creation? You know? There's nobody asking that question. There's nobody saying, you know, I'm experiencing moments of happiness, but that's all they are. Even though I'm looking for a stable situation, I'm not getting that. I am getting moments of happiness, and it's even come to the point where when I have a moment of happiness, I feel the dread, because I know for a certain that it will come to an end. So the moment of happiness itself is even kind of tainted by that underlying dread that I try to push off to the side, but of course I can't. So until that question has come, then I just need to know what are the rules here in order to have a relative happiness and to continually improve my lot. That's very clear, and that's the Tatpariya, the first part of the Vedas. But the first part of the Vedas has a second part. That first second. The second part of the Vedas are called the Upanishads. And that has a different adhikari. Adhikari means the person who is qualified, who is qualified for that part, who that part is talking to. The adhikari for the first part, the qualified student or the qualified person for the first part, is the samsari, the one for whom this is the reality. The person who is qualified for the second part wants to know what this reality is. What is the reality of this? You know? What is the reality of this? What is the reality of me? What is the purpose in life? Is there any way to get off of this chakra of samsara? And so now, in the second part of the Vedas, you'll see there is the story of creation. The creation comes, there'll be the talking of Brahman, the nature of Brahman, the nature of conscious being, infinite conscious being, who is there before the manifestation of the creation, right? And who is there during the manifestation of the creation, and who is there in the resolution of the creation, who is there all the way through, and then there's a whole, what we call different prakriyas that are used, and the creation, the story of creation is one such prakriya, to make you step by step by step understand that when this whole creation comes into manifestation, included in and comes into manifestation from one infinite Brahman. This is like in the Mandukya that we're working on Sunday. If you go back to the beginning verses, this whole infinite manifestation comes from one non-dual Brahman. And included in this one infinite manifestation that we call the creation that comes into being are all of the jivas. What does that mean? That the whole creation comes from one conscious being, is sustained by one conscious being, and resolves into one conscious being. So when the creation is up, and here are all of the jivas, all of the individuals, each individual say, I am, I am, I am, I am, I am, I am. The I am that each individual is referring to is that innermost self, which is the one conscious being from whom the whole creation has come. And so now here, so this, remember, we're doing the Mandukya Upanishad, so it's actually referring back to everything that we've done in the first verses of the 12 verses of the Mandukya. You have to remember that. And so here what he's saying is that this separation between the jiva and Ishvara, the jiva and Brahman, that's that state of being separate for these two, that is something that is declared, discussed, talked about before this prakutpatehe, before there's the discussion of the creation itself. We're in the first part, we're in the creation. In the second part, there's the discussion of the creation that comes from that limitless non-dual conscious being that we call Brahman. So now what happens? What is really the Tatpariya of the whole Vedas? Where do the Vedas resolve? So he says, what he says here is that discussion of the first part of the Vedas is what we call gaunam. Gaunam means it's secondary. Gaunam is the secondary. In what sense? It says because it's anticipating a vritti. Vritti means knowledge, a knowledge vritti, which is yet to come. Bhavishya means that's something which will come. It's anticipating, it's gaunam because there's an expectancy of a vritti which is bhavishyat. It lies in the future. This vritti is not available now for the samsari. It's not there for the samsari, but we are talking about the entire creation. We're talking about Ishwara. We're talking about the jiva that is existing in the creation. And so what you're learning in the first part of the Vedas is all about the creation and what's going on within it. And so you're learning about dharma. You're learning about Ishwara. Ishwara means the conscious being, which is this whole creation, right? And the jiva's relationship to this creation, which we call dharma. So in learning this also, there's certain things that you're gaining when you understand your place in this creation as a jiva. You're learning what is dharma. You're learning that relationship with Ishwara. You're learning all of the rituals and all the prayers which are always evoking Ishwara. And so as that is taking place, you're situated in the creation in a way that is true to the creation that's manifest, and you're gaining antakarna shuddhi. Right? To the degree that I'm existing in the creation in a dharmic way, in my relationship to Ishwara and my relationship to dharma, to that degree I gain a certain shanti. The mind becomes purified. As the mind becomes purified, there's a vritti that forms. There's a vritti that will come. The vritti is that vritti that is born really of antakarana shuddhi, right? Crores and crores and crores of lifetimes of dharma, it says in that Viveka Chudamani. And that vritti is the vritti of a mumukshu, saying to the same Upanishads, tell me what the truth of all of this is. What is the truth of all of this? All of the first part of the Vedas give me an ananda, a happiness of fullness, which is only relative. You know, it's sukha dukkha, sukha dukkha, sukha dukkha, pleasure pain, pleasure pain, pleasure pain. Is there any way to get off this wheel of samsara? Is there any way? Is there anything about me that survives and is free of these opposites? Is there anything free of all of these opposites that I'm continually subject to? Is there any way to get off the bus? Yeah. They also use the example of the samsari is likened to somebody who is drowning in a river or drowning in the ocean, is going to be pushed up and pulled down by the tides, pushed up, pulled down, pushed up, pulled down. And every time, it's your little bit of sukha is that breath you get when you're pushed up. You get that little breath and then you're pulled down again. And you're pushed up and thank God you're so happy you got a breath. But then you're pulled down again. And at some point when you're getting that breath, you say, I don't want the breath. I want to get on the shore. Somebody's got to rescue me and get me on the shore, you know. Is there any way to get on the shore? That's the mumukshu. There must be something. And there is something. And so that something is what the need for that something, that mumukshutvam, is what needs to be born. So that's that bhavishyat vritti, right? That bhavishyat means that which is going to come, this future, that which will be, that vritti, that recognition, that understanding, that insight, is there anything else? Bhagavan, please save me. That is something that will come. And that, in fact, is really the tatparya of the Vedas. That's the reality of the Vedas, because the Vedas are considered within the tradition to be an expression of reality. It's an expression of Bhagavan. It's an expression of what actually is. It's a scripture of revealed knowledge of what? Of the nature of reality. And so we can look at the nature of reality within this creation, but what is the reality of the creation itself? Right? We can look at my relationship to Ishwara or to Dharma within the creation, but then who am I? Right? Who am I really? Am I only that jiva in relationship to Ishwara? But who am I really? Who is Ishwara really? What is this creation really? That question is what will come, right? And The answer to that is the answer to the great mystery. The great mystery of the who am I question. And the who am I question really is not just who am I. It's not who am I, oh well, you know, I'm a woman that lives in Berkeley and I'm teaching over there and doing this and that. It's not that. Who am I? Is there anything about me that survives this death? Who am I really? Is this all there is? Or is there something else? And that's something else I want to know. You know? Is there somebody who's free of these opposites that is free? That's what I need to know. And that person becomes the Adhikari for the second part of the Vedas called the Upanishad. So it's one Veda. So the top parya really, what is mukhya, the mukhyatvam, you know, what is primary to the whole Vedas really, is this knowledge, the knowledge of reality, because the knowledge of reality is what resolves the problem. You know, I can resolve the problem to a degree relatively by the practice of Dharma and my devotion to Bhagavan. I can relatively solve the problem. But I can't escape the duality. I can't escape birth and death. I can't escape the fundamental sorrow of duality, which is really birth and death, you know, disease, old age, illness, loss of my family, loss of my friends, loss of my capacities. When you talk to an old person, and you know, my mom, when she was about 80, she told me, which so many elderly people have said, and she was a very kind, beautiful person, but she said, honey, it's just no fun to get old. You know, you have to deal with this upadhi. You know, you're old. You can't move around. You can't do things. You know. So that's the condition, as saintly as you may be, as dharmic as you may be. There's suffering in this dvaita. There's loss in it. It's built in. You know. Any happy moment has underlying suffering because it comes to an end. So there's loss. They're suffering within the happiness. So you're going to be asking as long as at some point, first of all, until you're a mumukshu, one who desires liberation, you're just going to be going on to the next desire right away, trying to keep feeding, keep solving the problem by fulfilling another desire. But at some point you realize it just doesn't work. You become a mumukshu. And then the second part of the Vedas is what is bright for you. So that's the first way this verse is taken. The second, and we'll unfold really with the next verse, but just to say quickly, you can also take the prakutpatehe before the creation, that if we take it talking about just in the Upanishads, before the creation is talked about, the manifestation of the creation, it always says, right, that this creation comes, especially Mandukya Upanishad, this creation comes from Brahman, that one non-dual self that is the self of all of this. In fact, I'll just go to this and tell you it's really kind of nice what it says here. It's the first verse.
Is this a quote?
It's the verse, one of the first verse. Just listen to these first verses, because then you can kind of understand. And I have to remember with this kadika. Kadika means that it's an unfoldment in verse form of the essence of the Mandukya Upanishad. That's what this is. So in the first verse, he says, Om iti etad aksharam idam sarvam. Starts with this. The sacred syllable Om is all of this. This entire creation. This sacred syllable Om is this entire creation. And it is this sacred syllable Om that we're going to be commenting upon thoroughly, that we're going to be thoroughly unfolding now. And then he says, Bhutam bhavat bhavishat iti sarvam omkara eva. This omkara, this sacred syllable Om, is everything in the past, bhutam, bhavat, everything that is here now, and bhavishyat, everything that will come in the future, all of this is om. Everything that is. And then he says, yetcha anyat trikala atitam tadapi om kadaha. And then he says, and everything that's beyond past, present, and future, whatever that may be, that also is om. So everything that is, past, present, and future, and what is beyond past, present, and future, that also is om. Okay? And then, in the next verse, he says, now instead going from the word om, instead of om, all, everything is om, he says, sarvam hi etad brahma ayam atma. And all of this, which has the name om, all of this, past, present, and future, everything that exists, past, present, and future, and that which is beyond past, present, and future, which is really the Satchit-Ananda Brahman. Okay? Mm-hmm. So everything that we are naming om, om is called pranava, it's the sacred name for all that is. He says, all of this, right, all of this is Brahman. Brahman means, and what is Brahman? And Brahman, so all of this that exists, past, present, and future, everything, plus what is beyond that, all of this is Brahman. And what is Brahman? Brahman is Ayam Atma. Brahman is the self. Okay? Brahman Ayam Atma, right? And Brahma. And so the Brahman, and this Brahman is Atma. And Brahma Saha Ayam Atma Chatushpat. Then he says, this Brahman is the self, right? And this self, which is Brahman, has four quarters, waking, dream, deep sleep. Okay? So he starts out with, in the first two verses, saying that everything that you experience is this Atma, which is infinite self, is this infinite self. And now he goes to the Chatushpat, the four quarters, which is the waking, dream, and deep sleep. Now we start talking about the creation, right? But you start with, this entire creation is nothing but Brahman. All of this is nothing but Brahman, which is what? Yourself. That's Advaita, right? There's only one thing here. This whole thing that you experience, this is Brahman, which is, what is Brahman? Brahman is this conscious being which you are. Right? And so now, from this point, the whole unfoldment of the waking state, the dream state, the deep sleep state, you know, all the whole nature of creation starts to be unfolded. But it's the creation, right? What comes before the creation is the recognition of non-dual Brahman. So that's the second way. Shankara, in his commentary, takes it in both ways. Okay. So. Find my place again. So understanding that in either way we take it, either the Karmakanda and the Jnanakanda, the Upanishads, or how the before we go through the unfoldment of the creation, it starts with the non-dual Brahman. Therefore, what is primary? In either sense, what is going to be primary is Brahman, is Advaita, not Dvaita. The creation is only used, the second way, the creation is only used to establish the Advaita, okay? To show you how all of this is nothing but that non-dual Brahman. And so the whole unfoldment of the creation, and the creation is unfolded in different ways. That's another thing we'll get into the next verse. The creation is unfolded in very different ways throughout the Upanishads, because that's not the Tatparya. It's not about the creation, right? It's about the non-dual nature of the creation, the truth of the creation. If it was all about the creation, like science, you know, you can't say science, you can't say the creation unfolds like this. No, it unfolds like this. Well, what is it? in this, they don't really care. They're very similar in the ways that they're unfolding it, but the Tatparya is not a creation. The Tatparya, what is actually the essence there, is what is the truth, what is the substance there of any creation. Like say, just to make this clear, say I'm trying to prove to you that in a clay pot, the good old clay pot analogy, say I'm trying to prove to you that really the nama rupa, the names and forms of the clay are nothing, of the clay are nothing but clay. Like say if we have a pot, right, I can say really the only thing there is clay, one non-dual clay. And so then I say, look, let me change this pot into a plate, right? Now I've changed it into a plate. Now let me change it into a tumbler. So now I've gone from clay ball to pot to plate to tumbler. And each move along the way, I'm showing really that there's only one clay there. The clay has not changed. Now what if I come along and I say, let's go from pot to plate. We'll go from pot to plate to tumbler. And then we'll go to pot. Pot, tumbler, plate. Or should we go plate, tumbler, pot? It makes no difference. It makes no difference because no matter what order we're doing it, we're using it to show that there's only clay there. And so in terms of the unfoldment of the creation, every step along the way, whatever we're doing, the Taittiriya is doing it in a different way, the Mandukya is doing it in a different way. It's to show you all the way along the way that the only thing there is Advaita. So the creation comes, it is sustained, and it resolves into the one non-dual Brahman. So that's the Tatparya there. Otherwise, it's not a science lesson about what's going on in the creation. Not that what it's saying is not true, it's just a different ways of saying, looking at the unfoldment of the creation in different ways from different vantage points. But in the end, all of them are showing the resolution of this whole thing as being just one conscious being that is you. Okay. So with that in mind, let's look at this next one, which just is a little bit same like this. Okay. Mriloha vispulinga jayihi. Mriloha vispulinga jayihi. Shishtiraya charitanyata. Shishtiraya charitanyata. Upaya sovataraya. Upaya sovataraya. Nasti beda katanchana. Nasti beda katanchana. Mrit loha. Vispulinga adyaihi shrishtihi ya chodita anyata upayaha saha avataraya na asti bedaha katanchana. So here he says, he's talking about the variable ways that the shrishti is creation is unfolded. You know, in the Upanishads, he says, mrit means clay, loha means, it actually means metal, it can be iron, copper, or gold. So if you see it translated as gold, it's choosing to use gold, but it's actually metal, often used means copper or iron or gold, so any type of metal, loha. Vispulinga means sparks, the sparks of a fire. So, adyahi, by these, etc., by these, etc. What by these examples, mrit, clay, the clay or the earth, iron, or sparks of a fire, the shrishtihi, chodita, is declared, is explained, anyata, variously, in a variety of ways. Anyata means this way or that way or this way or that way, in different ways. So, in the Upanishads, in the Mundaka Upanishad, I believe, is one of them where they use three examples. One is the creation is like sparks of a flame. They're using it like that to show, and the jivas are like sparks of a flame, remember that? What they're showing is that there's one flame, and that these jivas, these individuals, they're all simply just the same flame. They all have the same content. You know, the mrit, they use the, like the clay pot as an example, the mrit. The loha means like in the, I think it's the Chandogya, they use the fingernail clippers, you know. Fingernail clippers are nothing, you know, are nothing but loha. They're nothing but metal. They're nothing but iron. So the only point here is that they're using different drishtantas, different illustrations in the Upanishads to show the creation or the relationship between the substance, right? The substance and the name and form. Like mrit is like that, for say, like clay pot. The substance and name and form. The fire is a little different. It's giving up sparks, right? But the content is only one fire. They seem to be different, kind of like pot space, like there's space seems to be between these sparks, but actually the content is only one and the same. So these are called drishtantas. And so the creation is explained in various ways. Srishti means creation. It's explained in various ways by these different drishtantas and these different unfoldments. And he says, all of these are just an upaya. All of these methods of explaining the creation, they're just an upaya, which are avataraya. They're meant to resolve somewhere. These means are meant to land somewhere. Avatar, you know, the avatar is the one who comes down. It's the Ishwara coming down as taking a birth. But here it means all of these examples that are being used, they're meant to resolve somewhere. They're an upaya. They're a methodology. They're a prakriya that are meant to take you step by step to a recognition. Na asti bedaha katanchana. They're never meant to establish Vedanta. I mean, they're never meant to establish beda, duality. Na asti bedaha. There is no beda katanchana means of any kind. There's no duality that's being resolved here, that's being stated here. It's not like the Upanishads, when they're unfolding the creation, or it's meant to unfold to you, you see this is creation, there really is duality. You know, I'm showing you how the duality works, how the duality comes about. Here we have the duality, this is it. You know, this is what we have to say. No, the whole unfoldment of the duality resolves in, It's an upaya that's resolving in Advaita. In the previous verse, it says all of these upayas, all of these teaching methodologies, you know, they come after, before these teaching methodologies is the Advaita. And then the drishtantas and these illustrations are in support of that Advaita. So if I'm going on and on about the creation, I'm going on and on about the non-dual nature of it. Now, another thing to understand here, actually this is coming, it's very, very related. In the whole teaching methodology of the Upanishad, they have to start from and talk about and discuss the situation that we find ourselves in. We have to account for this creation, because here we are. Here I am with a body, mind, sense organs, living in a creation different from you and you and you, and certainly different from God, if there is one, right? Certainly different. You'd have to, if somebody was walking around and just saying, I am God, you think they are delusional. If they're schizophrenic will say something like that. I am God. Yeah? But they're, that's kind of a delusional statement. And so you experience yourself as an individual within this creation. Now, it's not enough for me to say, or for the teacher to say, don't worry, you are non-dual Brahman. Yourself, the self that you are, the conscious being that you are, is non-dual. You are all this. Well, first of all of this isn't non-dual. All of this is an expression of infinite duality, right? I mean, it's infinitely divisible, everything that we experience. So this is a manifestation of duality. And everything I know about myself as a conscious being is dual. My body, my mind, my sense organs, my thoughts, my moods, my emotions, my body itself is dual. It has hands and fingers and legs, etc. That's not non-dual. There's nothing about me that is non-dual. Though I can say in this non-dual me is that I am one me, one me. I am one me, I'm not two me sitting right here. But you're one me, so that's two me's. So the more we look at it, the more dual. But I want to know, is there anything about me that survives everything that I experience within this duality, which is a continual manifestation of change? There's nothing in this creation that is not bound by birth and death. Is there anything about me that survives that? It's like saying, is there anything about me that is free of birth and death? Is there? Because there's nothing in the creation that's free of birth and death, so how can I be free of birth and death? In this dual creation, you're asking for yourself to be an exception to birth and death. There are no exceptions. You try to find something in the creation that doesn't come into being and go out of being. Even in terms on a subtle level, your thoughts, your moods, your emotions. Try to have a thought that's not free of birth and death. It's an absolute impossibility. It would be like your mind jamming. like a computer is freeze or something. You have to turn the whole thing off. Right? It's not possible. And at the same time, you know, at the same time that we recognize there is nothing in this creation, including my body, my mind, my sense organs, everything about me, there is nothing free from birth and death. There is nothing free from change. And yet, amidst all of this change, I am, even experientially, me, is the invariable. You know why? Because I'm always here. Even though there's a problem, because even though I'm always here, I don't really know my nature. Experientially, I am always here. Like what I mean, just very, very simply. When I was a little girl, little girl body, that was me. Right? The teenage body, that was me. But the little girl body and the teenage body are very different bodies. In fact, the cells change completely every 7 years. So the little girl body, the baby body, that's me growing up. It's the same me in all of these bodies and the same me growing older also. So my mother in her 80s, she said, I'm not any different. I'm just in this really old body. And it's not fun, honey, she said. But she said that, you know. A lot of people have said that because that's our experience. Now look at this. Another thing that you notice, you don't have words for it, but when somebody tells you, you know what they're talking about. You may not have thought about it or said the words, but you know. You know, like every thought, every mood you have, the one who is happy is the one who became sad, is the one who became furious and angry, is the one who became calm, and the one who became at peace, and then angry again, right? But I am the one who is present. All of these, the series of emotions, they're all mine. When I say they're all mine, it means I was present to everyone. I am present to every thought. The thoughts come and go. The emotions come and go. The experiences come and go. The conditions, physical conditions come and go. Basically, it is this. Every single experience that I have comes and goes except for me. I don't come and go. Never. And so there is someone who is free from all of this. Because I'm never negated. Even waking, dream, and deep sleep, these are huge. The one who's the waker is not the one who's the dreamer. Right? The dream characters. But I am the waker and I'm the dreamer. You have to understand who you are between the waker and the dreamer. You have to give up everything that's in the waking world and everything that's in the dream world. Because you are both. So you can't be one or the other. You can't be the waking body and the dream body. You have to be the one who takes on the waking body and takes on the dream body. Right? So you're the self of these negating situations, waking state, dream state, deep sleep state. This is all the Mandukya Upanishads. You're not. You're never not there. And you know you're never not there. You might not put it to words, but it's just a fact. It's always you, 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 you. So if there's something going on in your psyche that's somehow knowing this. And that's why when Vedanta comes along, when the Upanishad comes along and starts explaining it all to you, it's explaining to you something that you've always known, but there's been a veil of ajnanam there, of ignorance there, that has not allowed your mind to put it all into clarity, into words. But it's all there to be recognized. And so all of these teaching methodologies, they're all upayas. Upayas means they're methodologies that are designed very with infinite brilliance, because the Upanishads aren't considered to be man-made. They're considered to be kind of a revealed knowledge that come along with this creation, which in fact is nothing but you in an infinite manifestation. So these teaching methodologies are just designed to remove that ignorance, that veil of ignorance, so you can see. You see what has always been. You're not seeing something new. You're seeing what has always been. And so it's just like a recognition of something you've always known but didn't know. You've always known it because it is you. So that way, experientially, as the experiential reality, you've always known it. But you haven't known it in terms of words, in terms of cognition, in terms of clarity, where somebody holds up a mirror and then you see, you see almost in an objectified your experience, which has always been. And so there's knowledge that takes place. There's a freedom that takes place. But all of this freedom that takes place is the freedom. It's the recognition of the freedom of my being that has always been there. All right, so it's not like you're gaining a free self. It's the recognition, I've always been free. I didn't know. I knew without knowing. Yeah. It's such a huge relief. It's a huge relief. So what Gaudapada is saying, he's citing some of these upayas, these teaching methodologies and drishtantas, illustrations that were used in the Upanishads, saying all of these, this srishti, it's taught in many, many different ways. They're all upayas. They're all upayas for the sake of landing avataraya, landing on something, right? There's no beta here. There's no duality here. Right? The tatparya of the srishti, the essential nature of the srishti is to make you see advaita, not beta. Beta means dvaita, duality. Okay. So, very beautiful. Okay, let me stop there. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om. Thank you.
I find it very intriguing that once it's pointed out that this me is always present, and you get this recognition, and that it resonates with what you haven't been able to say to yourself up till this moment.
Yeah. But once you see it, then you say, "Yeah, I always have been here."
Yeah.
Duh. It's not somebody else. It's me. Yeah. And you recognize yourself, you know. And the self that you're recognizing as free and changeless is the same self that was there when you were a little girl, or boy, and is here and now and all the way through. It's the same you. And it's that self that is Brahman. That's what you see.
Well, when you see that stable me, it makes you wonder how I could have not...
I know, that's
seen that.
That's right. That's in the Brahma Sutras, which is Shankara's great analysis of all of the Upanishads. It is the first chapter, the first introduction to it. It's called the Adhyasa Bhasha, which is it just like a 3-page analysis of Adhyasa, the superimposition. How I can take my being to be, this conscious being that's not an object that I'm looking at, how can I take it to be one with these things that are coming and going? When I still remain, right, I'm here, something comes into being as their experience and then it goes away, but I'm still here. How is it possible that this superimposition can take place? He says that. That's how he starts. How is that possible? You know? It's like, it's not possible for light and dark to come together. That's not possible. You know, for subject to become the object. It's not possible. And yet this is our situation. And then the whole commentary is kind of a unfoldment of that. Ajnanam, the wonders of ignorance.
The wonders.
The wonders of ignorance. Because ignorance is the cause of that type of superimposition. Yeah. Because the self is not doing the superimposition. Consciousness has no problem. It's the mind. And when you start understanding the situation, it makes so much sense, because your mind, which is mithya, which is part of the creation in a sense, it never, at any time, is away from consciousness. So why shouldn't it say, "I am the conscious being"? It'll say, I, the conscious being, am always changing. Because that's its nature. But this is the whole satya-mithya, the relationship between mithya, that which depends upon something totally for its being. But the thing which it depends on is free of it. You know, but from the standpoint of the mind, there's never a time that it doesn't exist. As long as it is, it exists. And as long as it is known, it enjoys consciousness. So unless somebody points out this satya-mithya relationship, it just takes itself to be that. It doesn't think, I'm actually an object of knowledge. It doesn't think that every thought, every emotion, everything that makes me up is something which is known and that comes into being and goes out of being. It doesn't think like that until it's pointed out. And then what can the mind say? It can't say, "Oh no, it's not like that." And it has to say, "Yeah, it is like that." Because it is like that. And every thought you have comes and goes. It's chain thinking, thought after thought after thought. Every emotion that you have comes and goes. Everything. Every experience you have comes and goes. If you were that, then you would also come and go.
But I don't.
But you don't. But that's why when it's pointed out, and all so many meditations and different ways of talking about that, it's just you see it from so many different ways until your mind then, instead of being the self, has a self. Right? That's a beautiful thing. It's like the mind then has a home base. And the home base that you are, so beautiful, so benign, so non-threatening. Yourself is your best friend, and it'll never turn on you. You know, because it's not... It's not subject to change. And it's, your being is so beautiful. It's so benign. That's why you like to meditate. That's why you like to go to bed, go to sleep. You love to go to sleep. Just knock out the whole universe. Knock out the universe. Knock out the mind, all of its thoughts and all of that. Just get rid of all of that. Yeah. Let me just, you know, just resolve into my being, really. There's still a jnanam there, but ignorance is still there. The standpoint of the mind, but there's no effects of the ignorance, you know. So I can just, Bhagawan gave us this beautiful time out that we call deep sleep. You can just, people, Swamiji makes a lot of fun of this, how we, you know, have nice comforter and wonderful pillows and a comfortable mattress and all of that, and just snuggle up and blot out the whole universe. Including my any association, any knowledge of my body, my mind, my sense organs, anything, memories, get rid of all of them. Just, okay. That's because yourself is so wonderful, you know. So in the waking state, once you have recognized that, the mind can just, with the awake mind, can just abiding in the beauty of your own being, can then handle the world. Because the beauty of your own being doesn't change. You know. So then the world can change and do all the things it does, but it can't touch you. Just like your mind can't touch you. Right? You're always there, present in the one illumining your mind. You're never touched by it. You're always exactly the same. So when the mind discovers that, that's such a relief. Because it doesn't matter what horrible condition my mind is in, myself isn't going to go, oh God, get out of here. Go away, go away. You're being unacceptable. Your behavior is unacceptable. Go away. You know, like a poor little child, the mother says, I can't stand the way you're acting. Please go to your room. Yourself won't say that. You'll just be there. And that way your mind is, has a safe haven. It has a place that it can always, when it's acting up or something, it can always just come home. And the nature of your being is so strong, so constant, so accepting, non-judgmental. That's such a beautiful thing to discover. Then your mind, staying home, experiences the world. By staying home, I mean, you know, your own presence is there as a blessing.
Radha, the likes and dislikes, are they like superimpositions upon the self?
Well, that's why we say mutual. This term anyonya adhyasa means mutual superimposition. So, let's say, if my mind is happy, right, then what I would say is, the person would say is, the mind would say, I am happy, right? The mind would say, how do I say that? Let me do it with just the mind. The superimposition is the mind takes me to be itself. So the mind becomes a conscious being, right? And then the self becomes limited by the mind. So if the mind is happy, the self becomes happy. If the mind is sad, the self becomes sad. That's the mutual superimposition. So now, when we say raga dvesha, raga means I have a like for something. I want something because I want it because it will make me happy. That's what we mean by raga. Dvesha means I hate that. I have to get rid of it because it makes me unhappy. So when I have a like, the superimposition is this, that I have superimposed the wholeness of my being, which is my own nature, onto the object. And then what I believe is that I have to have that object in order for me to be happy, or that person, or that job, or that situation, whatever it may be. I have superimposed the well-being that is my own nature onto the object, and then I have to go and get it. It's like I've superimposed my being, myself, onto the object, and now I have to go rescue it to get it back. That's the superimposition, right? And dvesha, it's the same. It's like that person or situation or whatever, it could be anything, honestly. It's not a person, place, or thing. It's person, place, or thing, or whatever. You know, become somebody that is taking away my ananda. And so I have to get rid of that to get it back. But actually, the ananda, that's the only ajnanam, self-ignorance, can allow for that superimposition. Right? Because if I knew the source of the ananda or the wholeness as being myself, which could never be taken away from me, then that superimposition can't happen. And it doesn't happen anymore. You may still want something or not like something, but it doesn't really matter because your being is not at stake. That's what we call a dugda bija. Dugda bija is a burnt seed. The desires act like burnt seeds. They don't sprout anything, right? Because the thing that causes us so suffering is, I need this to be happy. And by happy, I don't mean ha-ha like that. I mean my own wholeness, my own well-being, you know, at a very deep level, my wholeness, my well-being, my happiness. I need this to be like this in order for me to be okay, you know. And so that's life-threatening, in a sense. You know, if I don't get what I want or this doesn't work out in the way it needs to, I won't be okay. And so there's a lot at stake. But for a jnani, for somebody who has self-knowledge, that's what goes away. Even Ishwara can't take away my own okayness, because the self is not an object in the world. It's the very self which Ishwara is. Ishwara himself can't do anything about it. That's freedom. And there's never a time when your mind doesn't have the self for itself. The mind itself can't get away from the self.
It's always there.
It's always there as its very being, you know. And so the projection of that ananda starts to become withdrawn over time. There's an emotional lifetime because we come to this knowledge with a lot of raga, dvesha, and a lot of likes and dislikes. And by likes and dislikes, it means I need this. I need this to be like this in order for me to be okay. We come to this knowledge with that. It's not that you gain knowledge and all of a sudden every level of your mind goes... It's not like that. You know, it takes time for knowledge and understanding to assimilate into all the nooks and crannies of our psyche and all of the layers of likes and dislikes and expectations and all of these things. They all have to rise up. So you gain knowledge and all of it rises up into the person who has knowledge now and then goes, oh, okay, and then drops off. And then the next batch rises, oh, okay, drops off. Takes time. It's not instantaneous. The only thing that makes it easier, seemingly easier from one person than for another, is that one person may have, in the process of mumukshutvam, that desire for liberation, before they met their teacher, had worked through a lot of these things, realizing this isn't, you know, so this isn't going to do it for me. This isn't going to do it for me. This isn't what I need. So a lot of things have been shed. Or you come to knowledge right when that mumukshutvam starts, and you haven't shed any of that stuff yet. You shed it in the light of your knowledge. So it's just everybody, it's different for everybody. In terms of do you come having done a lot of the work? And then you come, and then that mumukshutvam comes at just the right time, and you gain knowledge having done a lot of that work? Or that mumukshutvam comes and you haven't done a lot of that work? So now you'll be doing all of that work in the light of your knowledge.
And it seems like that work is unique to each
different. It's all the same and it's very different. It's all the same in the big picture, that it's the resolution, it's the gaining of that vairagya. Vairagya means that truly embodied recognition that this doesn't really have anything to do with my happiness. It's fine. I can enjoy it when it's here, and when it goes, it's fine also. That's vairagya. It means my whole well-being is not dependent on this particular thing being one way or another. We have vairagya toward most things in the universe. They are not what a given thing, like, say, this cup. Now, who has vairagya toward this cup? Even I do, okay? If this little poor little cup, if it disappears or if I break it, I'll say, oh, that's a shame, and that's the end of it. All right? So how many things do you have vairagya for? Almost everything, except for a handful. And that handful is what complicates our life. That handful of things, you know, because it's interesting. You should go through, make a list. Make up the list of the things that you really need in order for you to be where your attachments are. And compared to the infinite number of things in the creation, it's not very many. Not very many.
I have this cup, and I got it in England, and it's a picture of Prince Charles and Princess Diana when they first got married.
Uh-huh.
And I use it every day, and I go like, oh, I'm very attached to this cup, and yet I know that one day I'm going to lose it, or
yeah.
It's going to break. Or,
yeah.
So I'm sort of preparing myself to be attached to that.
My favorite cup.
I've heard it said, not by you, but other non-dual teachers, that once you attain knowledge, you don't really care anymore about your stuff. Just to call it, put a name to it. You know, that it doesn't matter anymore.
You know, you have to be careful, because I think on one level, that's true. It doesn't really matter. You know, because everything by its nature, it will come and go. That's the truth of it. But that can be mistaken to then make you kind of, well, I don't care about anything. And that's not true. You care, but you don't ask you care, and you love, and you're engaged, but you don't ask the world to be different than what it is. You know? That's where there's a vairagya. I can accept the way the world is because my ananda is not dependent on it. And it's not that I don't care or that I'm not engaged, but I'm free inside. So one thing I see that this can get a little bit confused, like you equate being free inside, or you equate, you don't really do this, but you think that it's supposed to be like this, where you're free inside, which means that your wholeness or your well-being is not really dependent on a person or a situation being a particular way. Or if they come and go, or even if somebody beloved passes away, it's not that you won't feel sorrow and all of that. You'll feel sorrow and grief, but you're still the same inside because your being never changes. That's just a fact. The wholeness of your being does not change. It cannot change. The whole universe could go away. It still won't change. And so that freedom is there.
I didn't explain it really clearly. What they're referring to is that in reference to oneself and one's maturity, I guess you could say, or, you know, there might have personal issues that you haven't worked through yet. The stuff that would drop off.
Yeah.
You were talking about before.
Yeah, so that stuff will drop up. Yeah, so but no, I think what I was getting stuck on maybe is when you said they don't care, or does it?
Yeah, I guess the example that comes to mind is Mr. Gadatta and smoking
yeah.
cigarettes, and you know, he's messing up his body. Is that, you know?
Well, he knows he's messing up his body, right?
Yeah.
But a lot of people smoke cigarettes, and they know they're messing up their body, and they don't really care because they enjoy the cigarettes.
Yeah, I mean, it's not so much about cigarettes, but
yeah.
It's more of like, you know, there's all kinds of stuff that we could work on, you know, on ourselves that are the things that we haven't worked through.
Yeah,
you know,
you know
you're
what?
Saying someone comes to knowledge
you
when
mean,
they first attain Mamukshu Twambe.
You mean they
and
can...
They're going to have a lot to work through. But are they really going to want to have the motivation to work through that stuff?
You'll only have the motivation to work through different personalities, traits, or reactions and things if they cause you pain. If they cause you pain, then you'll work on it. Because it doesn't, it's like if you're, it's because it's natural to work on it if it causes you pain. If it's you're a little cranky or this or that, but you can just dismiss it, it doesn't really matter, you know, then you don't work on it. But if it causes pain, you will work on it. Just like if you hurt your arm or something, you'll do what you can to make it better. And then when it reaches a point of no return, this is as good as it's going to get, then you're fine with that. But you will do what it takes to make it better. Because it's normal. It's natural. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I guess part of what comes to mind is like you hear these stories of people in India who have attained some kind of realization, yet they're, I don't know, they may be...
cranky or something like that?
Yeah, or worse.
Well, I don't know about the Adharma. I don't really accept that. Because I think a person, whether they're a jnani, they have knowledge and are mature in their knowledge, even they will feel badly and guilty about their Adharma, what they've done. You know, and so you can't say, they can forgive themselves and accept that they've done that,
mm-hmm.
but that's something there that they've done that they have to live with. Because Swamiji told me that. He said, you know, that guilt, if you do an adharma, that the guilt of it, or if you've hurt a person, the guilt of that or the pain of that doesn't go away. You know, that, but you can accept that you have to live with those limitations. So I don't accept that that you get a freedom, internal freedom to do adharma.
Free ticket.
No, because that's a sociopath. You know, so you don't get that free ticket because the system, the Dharma system, the system, the order of Dharma includes the antakarana and everything.
Should be more sensitive.
Yeah, but the thing is that you can also say you make mistakes, like all human beings, we all make mistakes. There doesn't have to be somebody inside that's beating you over the head. You can accept that you made this mistake, and you can accept that, you know, you feel badly about it. And that's just the law. So you can accept the reality of that without, you know, falling apart or judging yourself or saying, oh, you horrible person. You know, you just pick up yourself and go on, and you do the best that you can. I don't accept the any type of ticket for a dharma. In fact, I think that the more whole that you are, the less there is any type of tendency. Sometimes we do a dharma out of real ignorance, and then you pay for it too. So.
And there are so many teachers though who maybe they're not fully realized or something, but who mess up in some way. There's some kind of a dharma that.
Well, you know, I'll tell you one thing. Where the teachers get into the most trouble is over sex, sexual relationships, or two.
Money, too.
Yes.
Yeah, sex.
Yes. Money. Sex and money. What else?
Power.
Power. Sex, money, power. Well, I guess for me as a psychologist. In our training, this, you know, being able to, for a psychologist is trained with a lot of study actually on the importance of not getting involved in any appropriate way with your clients, but so much emphasis is put on that because before, like I'd say the mid 60s or the 70s even, there was not consciousness around that. And since those forces can be so strong, you know, sexual attraction can be so strong that you're easily deluded, easily taken over by that attraction, and you fall into situations that are really very, very damaging for your clients. And so a lot of time has been spent in when somebody's training to become a psychotherapist or a psychologist, so that they really understand all of the dynamics that play into that, the harm that it causes to the client, all of that, so that there's consciousness around it. I would say for a therapist, if they get involved in anything like that, that is pure adharma. It is not ignorance. It's not that they haven't been trained. They have been trained, and they've made a huge mistake, which they have been trained that they know that they should not have done something like that. But that understanding of the teacher-student relationship, parishioner, priest-parishioner, like all of these type of power, where there's a power differential, especially in India, even today, that depth of understanding is not there. They don't know. You know, and so they can easily get into trouble. And so you see a lot of these, you know, gurus come over here, and then it's a free-for-all. It's a free-for-all, and they don't have the... It's changing now because there's more knowledge about it. But there, the Indians are used to growing up in a highly structured society where the men and women don't even have eye contact. They don't look at each other. There's no touching at all. Woman would never even come into the same room. Like, say the guru, the teacher, is in their kutir. A woman would never come in to that kutir. Absolutely not. No, that would be no possibility. Then it's not quite that way now. The times have changed. It's much more Western. Then it became, if a woman ever came into the kutir, the door had to be open. And to be a one-on-one, that was really something that was not done, you know. But that was also a protection,
yeah.
You know. There were so many rules, so much etiquette. So the teacher-student relationship was very protected by the cultural rules. And in India, the cultural norms are... You don't want to go against them. Because if you go against those cultural norms, your mountains of gossip explode all over the place. Yeah. So, you know, there's a structure. But there came a time with all this gurus coming in the 60s, the gurus coming here, and it's like a free-for-all. It's like a candy store with all of this freedom and all these movies that they never had seen anything like this before. So there's a whole period of time in the 60s and 70s that were kind of like a nightmare, you know. And then I see now, I know there's a lot of...
Still going on.
It's still going on. It's still going on. And power and money and sex and all of these things. But those people aren't real teachers. I don't believe them. I don't see them as real teachers. There's something's happened. There's something... They've gotten their lost people. They just seem like lost people to me. But I'm saying that people, even trained within a tradition, could get lost because of no knowledge to protect them. In fact, I know at our ashram in Coimbatore, even Swamiji, for the Swamis to even talk about this kind of thing, it's kind of too hard for them. They can't talk about it. Swamiji had me talk about it because I'm a psychologist and Western woman, so I can talk about the transference and about psychology, you know, the kind of how we're trained as psychologists and what is wrong with why these things are taboo and why they shouldn't be done and why you have to be so careful. We know all of this and we can talk about this, but in India, even to talk about it is not very comfortable.
It's a struggle.
It's a struggle. Like, you don't talk about these things. It's, you know, it's way too icky. intimate, not to be mentioned. So we see when they come to this country, we see so many terrible problems.
So
but I think it's getting much less in some ways.
Question.
Yeah.
So what happens? So presumably some of these people are yonis and have realized who they are, and then they make this terrible mistake and maybe multiple times. Do they work with it? Do they keep going? Some of them seem to just keep going and getting worse.
I don't accept that they're jnanis or ajnanis. I have no idea, but I think that if they're getting into trouble with that, then they're going to be getting into emotional trouble in themselves also. That it's a mess. It's a mess, you know, and you're trying to cover up the mess in one way or another, it just gets worse and ickier and ickier. And
so are you saying they couldn't know who they are really?
I'm not, I can't, stuff? I can't.
Or if
even,
they do, how could they do
Well, you know, I say like this, forget the knowledge part. Say you do something that you make a mess. You're a human being, you've done something, you make a big mess. But you're a good person, a dharmic person. Now you have to work your way out of that mess. Now, say you don't work about your way out of the mess, you just make the mess worse and worse and worse. And what are we going to say? You know, what are we going to say? Is there no values there? Or, you know, you have to know the person, you have to talk to the person and see what's going on. That's what, in psychology, that's what we do. If we see a therapist that is really going beyond the pit, doing something that's not right within that profession, we go and talk to them. If I see another psychologist who's getting into trouble or doing something, it's my duty to just go and talk to them and find out what's going on. Why is this happening? What's going on with them? Just as one colleague to another. Because you don't really know what's going on until you talk to them, then you have to talk to them and find out. And if they turn out to be a sociopath in the profession, then you would report them. That's how it is. If somebody's just gotten into trouble and they have somebody, they need somebody to talk to help get them out. But say it's not that. What if they say, who are you to tell me? I'll screw whoever I want, whenever I want. It's free pickings. And I would say, we have a problem here. You'd say, I have to report you. You know? That's in the psychology world.
But in India, you could be prosecuted for hurting the feelings of a religious group intentionally. You know, it's illegal. For example, there's a situation right now, a big one in India, where a woman published a book about a very famous guru who's committed many abuses now. Some of the just newspapers that published interviews with her and articles about the book were being prosecuted by prosecuting attorneys there for deliberately or wrongfully hurting the feelings or offending the religious sensibilities of a religious group.
Wow.
Yeah.
But is it similar to...
it's a holy hell, I think it's called.
Yeah,
right. I haven't heard of that, but is it kind of like here, it would be slander?
Right.
You know, as far as I can tell, truth is not a defense. I mean, I don't know, but it looks like if you look at the law, truth is not a defense, as in slander. Slander and defamation, if what you say is true, you can't be prosecuted. And there's a criminal prosecution, too.
Wow.
But they have this law, because of communal violence and things like that. So they passed this law that modifies the First Amendment right of freedom of speech. Anyway, it's a difficult situation.
Yeah, I'd say it is.
But you know what I think is, again, these type of situations, I mean, when it gets into, these type of things require education. And it's not just education on the part of these teachers, but on part of the students also. So the education then becomes the container. Before, it was kind of blind rules, you know, and putting up the particular walls and barriers so that things could not get, the barriers kept things from going wrong, but there was no education. Now those barriers aren't there. Now it requires education. And for that education to work, it can't just be both one way. It's everybody should have the education, but especially the teachers, but the students also should know that this is not appropriate.
I think in this particular situation, there's a political aspect of it as well, because some of the gurus are darlings of the BG, whatever.
Where is this in? Is it in? In what part of India is it in?
Kerala.
Oh, Kerala. Why don't I know about it? Well, I don't really keep up.
Which who was it?
It's Amaji.
The famous Amaji, yeah.
No.
But it's in the thing I read about it is saying that she was very much, and I think it was true of Sai Baba too. You know, there were certain political figures who were involved as well. So there was
It's complicated. You know, we don't know.
Yeah. We don't
know. Many of the top gurus are connected with top politicians. I mean, very much so.
Yeah. And that puts another.
You know what I always say, though? You know, you can always. It's icky.
And there's so much beauty in India, and there's so much beauty here. So just find the beauty and don't go for the icky.
That's just what I was going to say. Because there's so much truth in that. There's a lot of truth in that.
Yeah.
You know,
I would say even at the ashram in Coimbatore where you're going, Hal. It's such a beautiful place. This knowledge is so beautiful. The temple is wonderful. There's everything. It's so traditional. It's beautiful. And there's this all this shadow gossip and this and that and this and that. You have to just focus on why you're there.
Okay.
You know, because minds are minds. You won't really experience it, but the beauty lasts. Last for 6 months.
Oh, so
six months. We'll only be there 3. Yeah. But after 6 months, all hell breaks loose.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because just in people's minds, there's just a lot of material starts coming up, and then, you know, the newness of the place has come up, and all of these people have to deal. Like, it's 60, 70 people in a small place, and they're all living together, and that's not easy. But you see, the thing is it's not easy, but it is a structured environment, and there's a tremendous amount of growth that takes place in that it's a cauldron. At first it's a honeymoon, then it's a cauldron. You know?
I experienced that when I was there of older students who've been there a long time coming to me and
because,
kind of dumping out.
And they've got stuff. They're all working through.
Yeah.
You know, you think that everybody there is the same. No. They're young people who are mumukshus, who are coming to get this knowledge, and everybody has their own stuff they have to work through. That's the reality, you know?
So, are you familiar with those kind of techniques like EFT, where people do tapping on their body to resolve certain issues?
Yeah, I've heard about that. Yeah.
Okay, so what...
I don't know about it, though. Yes, I have.
Okay, so you clear, like, emotional stuff by doing it.
Yeah.
So you said make a list of all your attachments to see what you have vairagya, and then this is such a small percentage of the universe. So if you made that list, could you use like non-Vedantic techniques to just go through and just start clearing attachments to them? Is that something you would feel good about?
The thing is that, there's nothing wrong with that. The only thing I would say is that with the difference between Vedanta and these techniques, which are helpful in terms of psychological issues and resolving them, because those are all relative. There's a fundamental problem that is not relative. The fundamental problem is that I don't know that that the ananda or wholeness that I seek is my own nature. I don't know that. And so therefore I keep trying to find myself in the world, you know, to gain that wholeness, which is really my nature. And I can't gain it because it's not out there, it's me. And what's causing me from not recognizing that is that ignorance. And so even though these relative techniques and also analysis, psychology, all kinds of things, they are relatively helpful and useful for resolving different psychological problems, but they don't take care of this fundamental problem. When the fundamental problem is taken care of, then these different types of techniques really are helpful. Mm. They're really helpful because there's already a point, the fundamental problem has been taken care of. Otherwise, you take care of all of these things, but you're still sad. because you still don't have yourself. Yeah.
And this would go for dealing with the problem we were talking about before as well, how to deal with all the negativity that might
there's positive, well, yeah, you have to, but I think that the best thing when you're in a situation like this is to, and say you're living in an ashram, is to be focused upon to why you're there. And don't get into hanging out and socializing and gossiping and getting involved in all of the muck that is being stirred up. Focus on doing what you're doing. You know, and I think for many, many people, that's exactly what the ashram experience was. They were there to study and to learn and to contemplate and to, it was a more of a solitary time between them and the teacher and, you know, and the temple, and temple is so beautiful. It's absorbing, you know. That's what you're doing. And then it really blesses you. And then all of the gossip and all of that blesses you too, because you learn not to do it. You really realize this isn't help, it's not, doesn't help. And it's more than that. It doesn't help in life itself. And so you're in this cauldron, which is like life smashed in. It's very intense, you know, and you learn very quickly. That's why it's good to be there for a period of time, because it's all, life is very condensed, you know, and you have a lot of exchanges, and I don't know, it's very, very neat. There's, I was saying, I always felt when I went there in the 72, those 3 years were the happiest years of my life. Even though I can't really say that now because I don't feel this as unhappy, but that's how I felt during the time. And I felt that it was in heaven in a way. Yeah. Yeah. And it's not because there weren't problems there. This petty stuff and that petty stuff, but it didn't matter because I was there and I was studying, you know, and I was getting this knowledge and learning Sanskrit and being with Swamiji and being in satsang. There was, you know, there's nothing else that I wanted. You know, the other things, you know, didn't matter compared to that. And I was so busy studying anyway, but your time is taken there. It's a very busy schedule.
Yeah, that's a very generous ashram.
Yeah.
The way so many classes are given.
There's so many classes and so many things you want. There's hardly any time to study.
Because
You're always doing things from early morning till 9:30 at night.
Mm. Yeah, people would be literally running from there. Yeah. To
and
so
then
taking
extra classes from somebody who's more advanced in Sanskrit or something, and they're getting behind, so they'll take an extra Sanskrit class and they want to learn this chanting, and you get greedy for knowledge, you know.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful place. It's so worth it if you can spend any time there, but it's, I think 10 days is kind of the minimum for me. If I go there for 10 days, I'd really feel like I've just been able to be there, you know. It doesn't seem like very long, but you're there. You know, you're there for that time. And if you can go for a month or 2 months or 3 months or 6 months or whatever, it's wonderful to be able to do it when there's teaching going on. So, I'm glad you get to go.
Me too.
How long are you staying here?
3 months.
Welcome. I go back every year. For anywhere from 10 days to a month, just depends on the year. And my schedule, you know, my own things I have going here.